beginning at the beginning of the 1800s, with the beginning of the reform movement, the Siddur underwent major, major renovations. And what's so interesting is, and I don't think enough people do this, to really understand the development of the conservative and the reform movements, you really have to study their Siddurim. So what I want to do tonight is I want to study the Siddurim of the conservative and the reform movements, see the changes that they made, and see why those changes were important in the development of the movements. Well, first of all, just 1 minute. I don't want to make this class a history of the reform and the conservative movement, because if I do that, we won't have enough time to talk about the Siddurim. So just 1 minute, the reform movement, and the reform movement was the beginning. The reform movement began at the beginning of the 19th century, at the beginning of the 1800s in Germany. And basically, the early reform movement did not want to break from orthodoxy. They wanted to reform orthodoxy. So therefore, you know what their major renovations were to the service? What were the major changes of the early reform movement? Number one was a sermon in German, right? It used to be the sermon was in Yiddish. Now the sermon is in German. What else? What else? No, that was later, because that's already changing the Siddur. Originally, the davening was exactly the same. Number two? Piyutim. Your kumbork is a little one. Piyutim. How many times we talked about the fact? How many of us grew up on the Shabbosos around Purim and Pesach with Yotzros, right? The long, long Yotzros, right? Which I still remember was only the Chazan and the Rabbi used to say those Yotzros. Well, now Yotzros are not said by many Orthodox. But in the 1800s, they were said by all the Orthodox. Those long prayers on the special Shabbosim, on the special Shabbosos, the Reform movement took them out. That is far from, you know, from heretical to do that, right? What? Yes, that's right. Okay. And number three is decorum was very important, okay? They were upset that the shul was kind of what we would call today a shtiebel, right? Nobody, you know, people were talking and they came in and they came out and they stood up and they sat down. They established a certain decorum in the shul. If you want to appreciate what that's like, if you ever davened in KJ, now less so. If you davened in a place like KJ on the east side 25 years ago, you would have noticed that everyone stands at the same time and everyone sits at the same time. For instance, in KJ, the real KJ tradition is they don't stand for mourner's kaddish. Only the mourners stand for mourner's kaddish. Everybody else sits down. Now already, you know, there are people who stand, people who sit, all that kind of stuff. Where does that come from? That was really an innovation of the reform movement. It was decorum. I mean, it's not nice to have people standing and people sitting and, you know, people getting up a little bit for motive and all that kind of stuff. That was not what they wanted. They wanted to have a proper service. They introduced decorum. But what do you see from those changes? You see that that's not changing orthodoxy. That's not changing halakha. The early reform movement wanted to operate within halacha, within orthodoxy. But like all of these things, I want to thank I just want to say that there are 8 Torah in Motion participants today, meaning that there are 8 people who are actually watching this class, watching this class somewhere around the country, around the world. So I want to thank Torah in Motion for arranging this and Mark for setting it up here. But very quickly, the reform movement did introduce its own prayer book. The first major reform temple was in what city? The city of Hamburg. Hamburg was an extremely important city in the 19th century. In 1818, they founded the first temple in Hamburg. And with the founding of the temple, they introduced the first reform prayer book. Now, let me tell you about the first reform prayer book. First of all, it opened from left to right. What does that mean? How does the Siddur open? How does the Jewish book open? From right to left, right? It opened like an English book, okay? Or in those days, like a German book. That was the first thing. It didn't open like a Hebrew book. It opened like a German book. And number two is, that it had, instead of the Ashkenazi pronunciation, the transliteration had the Svardit transliteration. Now let me ask you, of those two things, the fact that it opened like a German book rather than like a Hebrew book, and the fact that the transliteration was Svardit rather than the traditional Ashkenazi, which do you think was more problematic for the Orthodox? The direction. You said the direction. That's really... No. Svardit. You're right. That's correct. They actually... It's surprising because I would have guessed also. Days near, if I came into shul, you know, they made a big fuss because the Koren, the English and the Hebrew, you know, switch sides here. If I came into shul and my sitter opened like an English book, you would think that's heresy, wouldn't you? That they didn't seem to mind. But the fact that they were changing from Ashkenazi to Svardit, that was considered to be absolutely unacceptable.
Or were they really upset by transliteration?
No, probably, yeah, that's good, that's part of it, but they definitely did not like the fact that it was turned into Svardit. Now let me tell you something. Some of you may know that there used to be on what the radio station Temple Emmanuel used to be on Friday night, WEVD or something?
Still is.
If you listen, now Shabbos is too early, but in the summer you can listen, what is it, 6 o'clock or 6:30? 5:30. So you can listen in the summer. It's interesting to listen generally. But I want to tell you something about Temple Emmanuel. If you go to Temple Emmanuel is Reform. It's high church Reform. There's no question about it. They daven in Ashkenazi in Temple Emmanuel. That's what's unbelievable. It's a German tradition that goes back, you know, 130 years here in the United States. They still daven Ashkenazi. That's the German tradition. They pronounce the word Ashkenazi, the words Ashkenazi. Okay, so that was considered to be problematic. But then, yeah.
Transliteration was not an issue in those days that it was the last 50 years with a political issue. That's the problem.
Why wasn't it a political issue then?
What would have been the issue? It had nothing to do with charged Zionism or anything like that.
You mean it was just to help you daven?
Exactly.
Okay, so it wasn't. It was interesting. Okay. Now, what I want to do...
Sorry, yeah. I have a quote. Why was a Svardit transliteration viewed as modernist?
Because it was a change from the tradition. It was a change from
what
the way that...
Tell them.
Good, you mean that. Now that's an interesting question. Meaning that nowadays, I know why you daven Svardit, because it's Israeli. Right? Even in the Orthodox circles, if you daven, if someone gets up and they have a chaz and they're Svardit, immediately you say, either they learned at a school where it's Svardit, or they spent time in Israel. What? Good. That's a very good question. What's the answer?
There's a debate within this shop.
Yeah, what's the answer?
No, because a lot of early reform was informed by...
Good. Good. That's a very good question. Sorry, I should have said this. They believe, for scholarly reasons, that the more correct pronunciation was the Svardit pronunciation rather than the Ashkenazi pronunciation. Okay? I don't know today what the thinking about that is. I think today they don't really know. There's no such thing as the correct or the not correct. I think today they think that the Yemenite pronunciation is the more correct. Oh, that's wrong. Yeah. Shouldn't have gotten involved in this, yeah.
The earliest we can go back is what we call Palestinian Tiberian Hebrew, which is actually around that same time, 800, 900.
Right.
And as far as we can tell, it's closer to what we would call Mishpah Ashkenazi.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Between the commas and the patah.
Okay.
Two different signs for it.
Good. Okay, that is a good question, though. It's interesting. I thought also, Arthur, that in a sense, they want to move away from the shtiebel. See, I understood it sociologically, and that is they want to move away from the shtiebel. Anything they did in the shtiebel was bad. Now, why is it bad? You know, the decorum, you know, the lack of decorum, I know why it's bad. The fact that they, you know, that they had an accent, you know, an, you know, Ashkenazi accent, or we would say an Eastern European accent, maybe, that's not... That's not objectively bad, but it's subjectively bad. It's what they do in the shtiebel. We don't want to be like in the shtiebel, right?
I mean, it's been also connected with the costumes that people wore. that the people had
clothing. They wore nicer clothing. Very good. Okay, you mean that they didn't wear, they wore German clothing. Okay, they didn't, that had to do with the decorum as well. Okay. These are all interesting, but I promise not to get involved in the history of the Reform Movement. So what I want to do tonight is as follows. I want to take several specific issues in the sitter, and I want to show how the conservative and the Reform Movement address those issues. The first is Musaf. Now, what's the problem with Musaf? What's the problem with Musaf? The problem with Musaf is that Musaf, the additional prayer on Shabbos, is a prayer that commemorates the sacrifice. In the traditional version of the Musaf, we say what? That we will in the future also give the sacrifices. How did the Reform Movement feel about sacrifices generally? How did the Reform Movement feel about sacrifices? What? They didn't like sacrifices. Why? Because they were barbaric and they were old-fashioned and all those kinds of things. The Hamburg Sitter in 1819 had Musaf. Again, that was early Reform and had Musaf. But by 1844, the Reform Movement was uncomfortable about Musaf. Now, in those days, I have to tell you about the Reform Movement. They liked conferences. Now, this is important just about the history of the Reform Movement. When you have a very small movement, you know, at the beginning, you know, of certain movements, they have conferences. You know, Lahavdil, you read this last month about the J Street Conference. It's very important for new movements to have conferences. Why? Because if you bring everybody together, it shows the strength of your conference. So every year, beginning in 1844, the Reform Movement, the Reform Rabbis, used to have a conference. And they used to bring together all the Reform Rabbis, and they used to be strength in numbers, and they used to discuss these issues. In 1844, the conference was in Brunswick, a city in Germany. And they appointed a commission on liturgy to examine Musaf. Okay, let's give you that. That's the first thing that's just great, right? That was the job of this conference, to see, to give a report the following year, whether or not the Reform Movement should daven Musaf. In 1845 in Frankfurt, they came back with a report. And look on the first page of your handout. This is a report given in 1845 at the Rabbinical Conference in Frankfurt. Here it says, "We are further from making a decision in the case of the Tfilot Musafim. According to the principles which the Commission has established, in connection with the doctrine of the Messiah, there seems to be no room in the new liturgy for these additional prayers." Meaning that they believed that the Messiah was not going to change things, there wasn't going to be a third temple or anything like that. "For if we eliminate the passages dealing with the restoration of the nationality, of the temple, and of the sacrifices, we are left with only the first three and the last three benedictions, together with only one other passage, all of which already occur in the Tfilot Shacharit, and which, if recited once more, would be a tiring repetition." It's great, right? It says, if we knock out all the references to sacrifices and rebuilding the temple and all that kind of stuff, we're left with nothing. It's just a repetition of chakras. And then what does it become? It becomes a tiring repetition. "As against this," he says, "though, we have to bear in mind that on the High Holy Days, we cannot very well do without those prayers. Thus, if they were to be omitted on Sabbaths and festivals, a disturbing unevenness in worship would result. The commission, therefore, is divided on this matter." Now, this is a great paragraph. This paragraph is worth the whole show. What is this paragraph grappling with? What's it grappling with? It's grappling with ideology versus a practical issue. Why couldn't they do away with Musaf on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
Because that's what everyone came to.
That's exactly right. You see, there's a problem in the Reform temple. What's the problem? It also comes up in some Orthodox shuls. That is, people come late to davening. If you eliminate Musaf, then what happens? They miss everything. Especially on the high holidays, when, you know, they have the only time they come to shul, if they come late and there's no Musaf, then what? then you have nothing. So ideologically, we have no place for Musaf. But practically, if we don't have Musaf, at least on the high holidays, we have nothing.
They need the other solution. They need to start at 9:30.
Yeah, yeah. They're German. They didn't know about that. So you see that. I mean, and this is a report. You understand? This is not some discussion that took place in a back room. This was the official report that was given to them. And they didn't know what to do. So what did they do? Obviously what they did was, they brought it back for the next year, right? They put the Commission on Liturgy was sent back for the following year. And in 1846 in Breslau, they had another conference. And here you have the plan. This is the plan of the new prayer book for the public worship of the Israelites. And here it goes. The contents of the silent Musaf devotion might be the following. God in the past ordained the sacrifices, and particularly for the festival. B, God has destroyed the temple, and as a consequence, he has abolished the sacrificial cult. C, our spirit surrenders to God, it soars without mediation towards the Spirit of God. D, passages from the prophets about the substitution of the heart's surrender for the sacrifices. E, prayer for the restoration of the temple in Jerusalem where all nations will worship God in spirit. So what does Musaf look like in 1846? It talks about sacrifices, but it talks about sacrifices in the past tense. And what do we have today instead of the sacrifices? What we have is prayer instead of the sacrifice. Okay, that's a good compromise. I mean, we'll have Musaf, but we resolve the problem that we don't like sacrifices anymore by talking about sacrifices in the past tense and not in the future tense. Whose view is that? Who does that? So to turn to the next page. Here on the next page I have the Sim Shalom Siddur. Now let me tell you a little bit about this. There are several editions of the conservative Siddur. Most conservative synagogues to this day use the Sim Shalom Siddur. Okay? However, it's gone through several editions. The first edition was in 1985, and it's been reprinted. This is its own story. There are changes from the 1985 version to what this is the 2002 version. I decided to get the most up-to-date version, and therefore I did not take this out of the JTS library. But what I did was I went to the shul in JTS, and I borrowed a sitter, because I figured that the way that they're davening in the shul in JTS reflects the most up-to-date conservative sitter. So everything I bring you from the conservative Siddur is from the Sim Shalom 2002, which is taken from the synagogue here, with the dedication plate and everything inside. What do they have? Musaf for Chol HaMoed. V'havienu l'tzion ircha birina, v'lushalayim beis mikdashcha b'simchas olam. They say b'simchas olam. Shesham asu avotenu lefanecha et korbinotehem. In the past tense, they say that in the past our forefathers gave sacrifices, and they say that musaf yom chakasukos hazeh asu vihikrivu lefanecha biahava kimitzvas ritzonecha, and the musaf of Sukkot or of Pesach. They gave before you in the past tense. The same thing applies to Shabbos. I just happen to have a weekday sitter here, so I took for Chol HaMoed. Now, what's interesting about this? This is whose view? This was the Committee on Liturgy's view in 1946 in Breslau. The Reform Movement's view has been adopted by the conservative movement. This is the official Musaf of the conservative movement. What about the Reform movement? What about Mishkan Tefillah? What kind of Musaf do they have in Mishkan Tefillah? You're welcome to look at it afterwards. I didn't bother making a Xerox because There is no Musaf in Mishkan's view. Okay? The Reform movement today does not have Musaf. Across the board, they do not have Musaf. We'll see what they do at the end of the service. It's interesting. They do not have a Musaf. They actually have become more radical than the decision of 1846. They have completely and totally eliminated Musaf. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they have a service, but it's not a Musaf service. That's what, you know, to address the fact that people come late. They have a service, but it's not a Musaf service. So that's the first thing. The first issue of Musaf. So you see an evolution. You see, first of all, it's just to review. What's interesting? What's interesting was it was a debate within the early reformers, right? That's fascinating, right? The practical question versus the ideological question. The decision to talk about the sacrifices in the past tense, which is adopted by the conservative movement, the reform movement, has eliminated Musaf completely. Okay? Orthodoxy obviously doesn't touch Musaf. The Musaf in the Koran Siddur is exactly the same Musaf as is found in the Siddur of Rav Amram. Okay? Also, don't need to quote that to show that to you. That is what it is. Okay. Now, the next thing, the next issue is the question of references to Zion and Jerusalem. What was the problem with referring to returning to Zion and Jerusalem?
Right.
They were concerned about dual loyalty. They were very proud to be Germans. There were two things. Number one, they were proud to be Germans. Number two is they were accused of dual loyalty. That you're not really good Germans because your heart is in Jerusalem. Look at your prayers. So David Freelander wrote in the year that the Jews of Prussia achieved their emancipation. Look on page 278. Indeed, it requires no special mental effort, only rectitude of soul, for the religious Israelite to say to himself, here I stand before God, I pray for blessing and success for my king, for my fellow citizens, for myself, and for my family, and not for a return to Jerusalem, not for a restoration of the temple and the sacrifices. Such wishes I do not have in my heart. Their fulfillment would not make me happy. My mouth shall not utter them. Now here you see something which was kind of the opposite of Musaf. And that is that in the early years of emancipation in Germany, they felt more strongly not to mention Zion and Jerusalem. As time goes on, what happens? They relax a little bit about it. Yeah, well, because the Jews, well, the Reform Movement was no longer questioned as much. They were seen as being good Germans. Those who didn't want to affiliate fell away. So Zion and Jerusalem became less of an issue. And therefore, if you look on the bottom of the page, on 278, there's an amazing debate between Abraham Geiger and Manuel, how do you pronounce that name in German? Bella Yoel, they say in German? On the bottom, page 278, J-O-E-L, Yoel, okay? Who were they? They were the rabbis, this also is kind of fun. They were the rabbis in the Reformed Temple in Breslau, right? A major German community in Breslau. Abraham Geiger wrote a siddur. He became the rabbi, he wrote a siddur. Yoel was his successor, and he, of course, when he became the rabbi, he amended the siddur of Geiger. And one of the disputes that they had was whether or not to mention Jerusalem. Look what Geiger writes on the bottom of 278. Jerusalem and Zion are places from which instruction went forth and to which holy memories are attached. But as a whole, they are to be celebrated more as a spiritual idea, as the nursery of the kingdom of God, than as a certain geographical locale connected with a special divine providence for all time. What does Geiger say? Jerusalem is an idea, not a place. Very simple. It's an idea, not a place. We don't want to go back to Jerusalem, the place. We want to go back to Jerusalem, the idea. What does Yoel say? There has never been any argument about the fact that Jerusalem has to be mentioned in the prayer book. if one has but the slightest idea of the essence of worship, he will declare a Jewish prayer book from which Jerusalem is missing to be resting upon faulty liturgical principles. That is a great argument, right? Geiger says Jerusalem's an idea. Yoel says any sinner that doesn't have Jerusalem is not a sinner, right? So, what does the Reformed prayer book have now? So where would you look, everybody? Help me out. Where would you look? Okay? One of the blessings in the Shemoneh Esrei, we ask to go back to Jerusalem. Okay? This is the text of the traditional blessing. V'lirushalayim ircha, to Yerushalayim, our city, berachamim, with kindness, with mercy, tashuv, may you allow us to return, right? Look at the top of the next page from the Mishkan Tefillah. This also is great. V'lirushalayim ircha, berachamim tifneh, and turn in compassion to Jerusalem, your city. May there be peace in her gates, quietness in the hearts of her inhabitants. Let your Torah go forth from Zion and your word from Jerusalem. Blessed is God who gives peace to Jerusalem. What word is changed there that's unbelievably significant? Tashuv to Tifneh. What is the word tashuv to tifneh? Tashuv means
return.
Tifneh means face. Think about. We don't want to go, but we'll face Jerusalem.
Yeah. Now, isn't this liturgy already influenced by Israel? I think that there must have been an.
Good. Very good. So again, like I said about the Sim Shalom, there's a whole other class that traces Reform liturgy through the ages, from the Union Prayer Book to Gates of Prayer to Mishkan Tefillah. I'm going to get to that point in 1 second, okay? Right, this already is a Zionistic bracha, meaning even with the acceptance of Israel, you have, it doesn't say return to Israel, it says face Israel. Now, I have an interesting thing here, and this I will admit is just because I must just have a preliminary version of this siddur. Because in the table of contents of the Mishkan Tefillah, it says contents for the final edition, and it has all these page numbers 00, and there is a service for Yom HaTzmaut, for Israel Independence Day. The problem is that this siddur doesn't have it. So there might be a more recent Mishkan Tefillah. I will tell you, just to let you know that I did do my research, I went to Rodef Shalom on 83rd Street, right, the Reform Synagogue. I thought, if they don't have the most up-to-date Mishkan Tefillah, by the way, Rabbi Levine, and I got the idea because Rabbi Levine's name is in the introduction as being one of the advisors, so you can't do better than that. So I went there, and I went to the shul, and I went and looked at their Mishkan Tefillah. They don't have a Yom HaTzmaut service in their siddur either. So either it should be either there somewhere and just nobody has the siddur, or it never actually happened. But it is interesting that it is in the table of contents in the Reform Siddur. Okay, but you're right. Even in the most updated version, they don't return to Jerusalem. What about the conservative movement? How does the conservative movement look at Jerusalem? So if you look at the conservative Shemoneh Esrei is exactly the same as ours, as the traditional Shemoneh Esrei. V'lirushalayim ircha barachamim tashuv. Right? Exactly the same. The conservative movement does something that really struck me as being unbelievable. Someone pointed this out to me. Look at the next page. This is a page from the Shemoneh Esrei in Shalom, the conservative Shemoneh Esrei for during the week. What is unbelievable on this page 42? Everybody with me on page 42? What's unbelievable on this page?
They have an
Al HaNisim for Yom HaTzmaut. Just one word on this. Yom HaTzmaut is a big problem in Orthodoxy as well. because there's no liturgy for Yom HaAtzmaut. We all know that, right? There have been attempts to try to create some kind of liturgy, but there's really no liturgy for Yom HaAtzmaut. There's no addition in the Shemoneh Esrei because but it's not liturgy the way we have liturgy for Chol HaMoed or liturgy for Rosh Chodesh. But look what the conservative movement did. They created a liturgy for Yom HaAtzmaut, and they decided that the prayer that was most similar for Yom HaAtzmaut was what? Al-Anisim, just read it in English. In the days when your children were returning to their borders, at the time when our people took root in its land, as in the days of old, the gates of the land of our ancestors were closed before those who were fleeing the sword. When enemies from within the land, together with seven neighboring nations, sought to annihilate your people, you in your great mercy stood by them in time of trouble. You defended them and vindicated them. You gave them courage to meet their foes, to open the gates to those seeking refuge, and to free the land of its armed invaders. You delivered the many into the hands of the few, right? That's Rabim Biad Miatim, that's Al-Anisim. The guilty into the hands of the innocent, Rishayim Biad Tzadikim. You have revealed your glory and your holiness to all the world, achieving great victories and miraculous deliverance for your people Israel to this day. It's very interesting what they did. Now, I know why the traditional sitter doesn't do this, because they don't want to add to the Shemoneh Esrei. But in a very serious way, this idea of giving liturgy to Yom HaAtzmaut in the Shemoneh Esrei is really very brilliant. I mean, it gives Yom HaAtzmaut a certain credibility that the Orthodox sitter doesn't really give Yom HaAtzmaut. Now, why did I bring this here? Because not only does the conservative sitter keep Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, Yericho, Barachah, Mitzvah, but they recognize modern-day Israel in their sitter. And here again, what Mr. Max said is 100% right. Israel and Israel, Jerusalem, Zion was much more of an issue in Germany than it is now. You see, Musaf is an issue across the board. Because the question of, you know, of whether or not we accept sacrifices in the future, that's as much an issue in America today as it is, or in Israel today, as it was in Germany. But the idea of dual loyalty was very much a German question. In America, we're not, you know, we don't have that problem, really, that we're, you know, we're accused of dual loyalty, right? Just the, you know, we live in a, you know, in a melting pot of America. You can have as many loyalties as you want. That's not the issue. So therefore, Jerusalem has been returned to the sitter, which is also interesting. Again, you see the ideology, but you see the evolution of the movement as it's reflected in the sitter. The whole question, that whole debate between Geiger and Yoel, whether or not Jerusalem should be there, today seems what? That seems antiquated. That seems old-fashioned. Who would ever argue about that? Who wouldn't want Jerusalem there? Right? Yeah.
With respect, I hate to disagree partly with you. It's partly right, therefore partly wrong. The return to Jerusalem in the Reform liturgy is a recent phenomenon. The Reform in America is very different from Reform in Germany. And early on, Reform in America was radicalized far beyond whatever it was in Germany. And very early, it was only the 1860s, everywhere was the temple and the sacrifice.
All gone.
All gone. And it wasn't a Jerusalem, whatever it was ideological. 100% ideological. It was a platform. And indeed, that was reflected politically throughout the 20th century. The Reform movement officially was not non-Zionist, it was anti-Zionist. Reluctantly, grudgingly, slowly, it went into the Zionist agenda. And that's, and Mishkan Tefillah, one of the things interesting about Mishkan Tefillah, it kind of represents, it can tell a little bit about the history of what's going on. So it's a reluctant return to Jerusalem.
Good, you're 100%. Obviously, that's right. I didn't want to get involved in that. American Reform in the late 19th century was more radical than German Reform for its own independent American Reform reasons. Right? You're right. It took 100 years to get over that. I didn't, you know. So I'm It's right. I'm cheating a little bit by looking at Mishkan Tefillah. I'll just say one word about that. The Reform movement today, and it's reflected in Mishkan Tefillah, has in many ways returned to tradition in terms of the liturgy. If you were to compare Mishkan Tefillah to the, what are they called, the Union Prayer Book? Union Prayer Book and Gates of Prayer, which were the Reform Sidurim, or prayer books, there's much more Hebrew and much more traditional liturgy. So there is a little bit of cheating here, but just because I want to compare them, I'm kind of jumping from Germany 1840 to New York 2002. Okay? I mean, accept it. Now, next issue, particularism. This is an issue that cuts through the Reform movement generally. What does particularism mean? That we're better than the non-Jews. We're better than the non-Jews. The Reform movement rejected particularism, right? They didn't like it to be said that we were better than the non-Jews. Where does that come up? Help me out. Where did that come out? Shelorasanu ki goye ha'aratzos velosamanu ki mishpechos ha'adama. Okay? Means you didn't make us like the nations of the world. Now, just a technical point. In the original Aleinu, the next line says, Shehein mishtachavim lahevel barikum ispalalim el elo yoshia. That they pray to idols and we don't pray to idols. Now, with that line, the particularism of Aleinu is not a problem. Because clearly it's referring to an ancient people. But they didn't have that line. So it sounds like, because that line was removed by the censors and they didn't have that line in the 1800s. So that line sounded very what? Very much as if it was comparing the Jews to the non-Jews, and the Jews are better than the non-Jews.
Yeah, but, and it isn't actually, historically that isn't what...
Doesn't matter, but that's what it sounded like. Now, what's the problem with Aleinu? Why can't they do away with Aleinu the same way they did away with Musaf? What's the problem with Aleinu? Tell me this. What's the problem with Aleinu? Well, actually, it's not in the Gemara. What's the problem with Aleinu? You're much too sophisticated, Michael. What's the problem with Aleinu? Can you imagine a...
Yeah? I'm attuned to it.
Of course! Can you imagine davening... That's the answer. Right? Can you imagine davening not ending with Aleinu? Can you imagine not having Aleinu in the davening? You laugh at that. But that's a serious consideration. Look what they did. Now here, I give you just some examples of different traditions concerning Aleinu, page 301. The Deutsche Synagogue, means the Berlin, the Reformed Synagogue in Berlin in 1817. Aleinu is not used as a concluding prayer, but only as part of the New Year Musaf service. The Hebrew text is not printed, but a rubric indicates that the traditional Hebrew text is to be recited. Translation. Who hath not placed us like unto the other tribes of the earth, not such is our portion, not like the lot of their multitude. What's going on there? Well, a couple of things. Number one is that they only say Aleinu on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay? Or Rosh Hashanah maybe only. The Hebrew text is not printed, but they say the Hebrew text. That's kind of a trick, right? It means everybody knows Aleinu can say it. And what do you say about the translation? And it's stronger in German, because, you know, high German, you know, what do you see about this translation? Say it. What does this translation mean? I don't know what it means, is what you're supposed to say. But it doesn't mean anything. That's what you're supposed to say. And if it doesn't mean anything in English, it really doesn't mean anything in German, right? Who hath not placed us like unto the other tribes of the earth? There are a lot of unto's and this and that, but you don't really know what it means. So they've kind of avoided the problem, but at least on Rosh Hashanah they've kept Aleinu, because you can't have Rosh Hashanah without Aleinu. Believe me, they didn't fall, you know, they didn't do Kogrim, they didn't fall on their faces for Aleinu, but you needed Aleinu. Hamburg, the same thing. You see Hamburg 1819 and Hamburg 1841, and you see the same kind of thing. So what did they do with Aleinu? They were stuck with Aleinu. And here on the next page you see something which I think is just great. Here's from the Mishkan Tefillah, and look what they do in Aleinu L'Shabeach. What do they do? What do they do here in Aleinu L'Shabeach? On the next page, you see Aleinu Aleph and Aleinu Beth? What does that mean? Talina, what does it mean? They give you an option. It's brilliant. You see, there are different ways to handle changes in the service. Let's just think about it for a minute. One way is to delete, right? To eliminate. That's the way they handle Musaf. Another way is to change. That's the way they handle really Yerushalayim Ircha Barachamim Tifneh. A third way, Mr. Max, is to what? Is to emphasize the translation and to change the translation. Right, Jonathan? To keep the original Hebrew, but assume nobody knows the Hebrew, so you change the translation. That's what they did with Aleinu. But look what Mishkan Tefillah does with Aleinu. It has the fourth option of how to deal with problematic prayers. It gives you a choice. Aleinu 1. Aleinu L'Shabeach L'Adon HaKol. That is, as it be translated, because that is the traditional Aleinu to the word. Okay? Aleinu Bet. Aleinu L'Shabeach L'Adon HaKol. L'Teit Kedula L'Yotzer Brishit. Let us adore the ever-living God and render praise unto the one who spread out the heavens and established the earth, whose glory is revealed in the heavens above and whose greatness is manifest throughout the world. You are our God, there is none else. What do? They eliminate the particularistic part of the Aleinu. Right, Jerome, it's brilliant. And what do? They borrow from what?
From the second half
of Aleinu, which is just talking about how wonderful God is. What do you think about this? What do you think about this, everybody? Come on, where's the rabbi in all of you? What's the problem with this approach? Jerome, what's the problem with this approach?
I don't know what the problem is, but I'll tell you what the Reform rabbis are telling me what the problem is.
Yeah,
they don't like Mishkan Tefillah. They say, give me a sitter, don't give me column A and column B.
Good, thank you very much. Good. Thanks. Come on! So, I mean, this it's just not reasonable. So what does that mean? Is half the shul singing Aleinu 1 while half the shul is singing Aleinu 2? Do they have a vote in board meetings in Reform synagogues to see whether they're going to choose Aleinu 1 or whether they're going to choose Aleinu 2? I mean, how does it work? You see, this is where, and this is a very important point, this is where, you know, kind of the study of the Siddur and the practical rabbinics lock heads, right? They don't mesh. Meaning, for our class, this is absolutely brilliant.
They yeah? Continue on different pages too, so they hold
on. You can look it up here and see. I don't know why. I'm not sure what happened. I didn't look that far, okay? One second. Let me see. You see, in study, it's probably just two sides of the same page, right? In study, this is brilliant. We've developed the problem of Aleinu. We've shown what happened, and Mishkan Tefillah has done what? Has the perfect compromise. The problem with all this is what? Is what? That practically it doesn't work. I mean, you can't have a sitter which gives you choices. It's like you can't work that way because you don't know what to do. So that's funny you say that. That's what the Reform rabbi say. So the question is whether the term we would use today is user-friendly. What is it? I'll get to you in a second. What does they have?
It looks like Aleinu 1 is more, it's the rest of the Aleinu. And Aleinu 2, they just cut out all those.
Oh, so it means it's just the next, it's really the next page. Yeah. Okay, Joe and Arthur.
If the problem with Aleinu was how it appears to the outside world, then you're printing it anyway.
No, they don't want the people to think that they're different than everybody else.
Yeah,
not only the way it appears to the outside world, it's how The Jews will think of themselves. We're not supposed to think of ourselves as being different.
Yeah, but you're printing it anyway, so even if it's eternal,
that's what you're saying, that when you get to Aleinu, even if you choose Aleinu 2, you know that what we really believe is Aleinu 1.
Wait,
that's a joke, but it's just right, okay.
It's a very obscure solution, because one of the more questionable parts of the text of Aleinu is
they don't know that fancy thing that it's the gematria of Jesus. They didn't know all of that stuff, okay? You know that, they didn't know that, okay?
What?
Yeah, Arthur.
What's the gematria of
Jesus? Your karo is you know, I have to answer this question. Everybody's interested in what I just said. Okay? There's a line in Aleinu which was eliminated for hundreds of years, which was reinstituted in the more recent Siddurim. That is, we say, that we're not like the non-Jews. They pray to nothingness. They bow down to gods that can't help them. And we bow down to God. Of all the lines in the davening, why in the world was that line eliminated? And if you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, in the article for Aleinu, they have the greatest picture in the world. They have an Italian sitter, and they have a line through that pasuk, right? That, you know, they have like a line. It was eliminated by the censor. What's the problem? The gematria, by the way, the Shem Yishak Mohel Barik is a pasuk, is a verse in the book of Yishayahu, okay? But the gematria, the numerical value of the word barik, is the same numerical value as the word yeshu, which is the Hebrew word for Jesus. And you might think that that's ridiculous, but we know from these sources that people used to spit when they got there. And the Taz, listen to this, the Taz, one of the commentators in the Shulchan Aruch, and I'm not talking about 1,000 years ago, the Taz lived in the 1700s. The Taz writes like this, he says, when you're saying Aleinu, in the laws of Aleinu, you can look it up in the Shulchan Aruch, he says, when you say Aleinu, to be careful when you're spitting, to spit at the word varik, don't spit because that looks like you're spitting at God. Yeah, now what?
I wonder whether this was thought to be an educational device, that at the time the community would be weaned from Aleinu Aleph, and the next edition would just have...
Good. I think... Well, it's funny you say it that way, because I was going to say it differently. It's an educational device because they weren't as concerned about what Aleinu you said. They wanted to discuss it.
And eventually to move people, perhaps, to be.
Well, or at least to open the possibility to move them to be. Or maybe to keep it at A. Meaning, the idea is that the Reform Service, nobody jumped at me, but you know, I skipped one sitter. I do not have the Reconstructionist sitter here. That's its own story. I didn't have time for that. But, you know, the idea that the service is part prayer and part discussion is a very important part, right? The Orthodox and the Conservative service is basically prayer, right? I mean, they make the davening a little different, but it's basically prayer. The Reconstructionist service is mostly discussion, less prayer. The Reform has both, and obviously, Jerome, that's an oversimplification, right? Each service has it a little different. So the fact that you can get away with two versions, it assumes that there's a discussion period here. Now, whether or not they wanted to wean them into, you know, to the next one, I guess the only way to answer that question, Arthur, is to wait for the next edition.
The commission changes and that gets thrown out anyway.
One
other quick point. This is just the tip of the iceberg of the Sefirot, right? Like, this is nothing compared to... which is so strange because one of the Reform tools substituted...
I know.
So, but what happens to the rest of it?
Good. You mean it's all over davening?
And this is not bad. This is a negative way, but you're a positive way.
Good. Or, you see, that's part of the problem. And of course, you have to say things like Yerushalayim. Tzion, just Google, you know, just put in the word Tzion in your Hebrew Google, which one X-ray. How many times the word Tzion appear in the davening? It's all over the place. You see, part of the problem is that they're not going to, you see, Musaf is easy. Because Musaf, you just press the delete button on Musaf, and Musaf goes away. But you can't make every reference to Zion go away. You can't make every reference, Ashabach Arbanu, go away. You're not going to change the blessings on the, you know, on the Torah. You just can't, well, one guy did, but basically you can't do it. So, you go, what are you going to do, right? So I'm just giving you an example, but you're right. See, the problem is, at some point, you're left with nothing. And that's also, you know, so we joked at the beginning, how can you do away with Musaf because nobody comes to Musaf? How can you do with Aleinu because Aleinu has a tune, and therefore, you know, if you don't sing Aleinu, then what are you going to have? So I only take the, you know, the more popular things, but of course, if you're going to change everything, then you're left with nothing. Okay? That's a very good point. The last issue. The last issue maybe is the most interesting of all. That is resurrection. Why is it interesting? Because this puts together this year's classes and last year's classes, okay? The Rambam writes about resurrection. The Rambam says, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima she'tiyeh tziyat ha'metzim. Right? The 13th principle of the Rambam is that you're obligated, a Jew is obligated to believe that there will be, what's tziyat ha'metzim mean? Resurrection of the dead. Traditionally, resurrection of the dead has been understood as physical resurrection of the dead, meaning that at some point in the future, those who have died will come back to life. The Enlightenment, and this was true about the Jews and the non-Jews, the Enlightenment rejected physical resurrection and changed it to spiritual resurrection, whatever that means. It avoids the problem. If you look in the Hertz Siddur, we know the Hertz Chumash, but if you look in the Hertz Siddur, the chief rabbi of England, in his notes on this 13th principle of the Rambam, Rabbi Hertz, the Orthodox chief rabbi of England, says that in the 1930s, 1940s, says that resurrection means spiritual resurrection. They did not want to deal with physical resurrection.
What's the problem with believing in physical resurrection?
Because they believed that that was crazy, that there was never going to be such resurrection, right? They thought that there was, it wasn't realistic.
People believe that for some long
time, the Enlightenment were rationalists, meaning that they wanted things to make sense. And physical resurrection didn't make sense to them. Right, that's very specifically. That was the Enlightenment.
Splitting the sea made sense to them? I mean, other things made sense?
No, they rejected all that stuff.
Oh, good.
Right? That's an easy one. They rejected, you know, the one authorship of the Torah because they thought that was not realistic. Right? I mean, they were rationalists. That was what the Enlightenment represented. Tchiyas HaMeisim, physical resurrection, was an expression of something that was not considered to be rational.
Yeah, okay? But the Rambam has a...
I know, I didn't want to get involved in that. You have to go back to the tape of last year's class, okay? So what does Mishkan Tfilah do? The conservative movement has... Sorry, where does this come up? So you say, Tchiyas HaMeisim is all over, but it's right there, it hits you right in the face. Where does it hit you in the face? The second bracha of Shmon Esrei, the second blessing of Shmon Esrei, is the bracha Mechaye HaMeisim. Look at the last page. Oh, look at the second to last page. What do we have in the second to last page? Okay? The bracha of Mechaye HaMeisim. Page 78. V'neman ata. Everybody with me? The underline. V'neman ata l'hachayos hakol meisim. Baruch ata Hashem Mechaye HaMeisim.
No,
Mechaye Hakol. Mechaye HaMeisim. It's also in the English.
In parentheses,
right.
You don't say it.
Faithfully giving life to all, reviving that which is dead. What's going on here? Of course, here
choice.
We go. Here's the choice. Here is our choice. Exactly the same thing that we had what? That we had in Aleinu, but they don't need two separate pages because this is just two words. So instead, they have it in parentheses, okay? Hakol and Hamesim. Now, this I'll just give you a little inside word on. There actually was an article written by Rabbi Neil Gilman, who is a professor of philosophy at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He's conservative. But he wrote an article kind of tracing this. He said that in the earlier Sidurim, in the earlier Reform prayer books, They do not have Mechayi HaMeitzim at all. They do not have mention of the of physical resurrection at all. This is a concession to tradition to put HaMeitzim in parentheses. You see, Arthur, that's an important point, because you have to know when they give you a choice, what's the default? Means what are they more comfortable with and what are they less comfortable with? So the answer is they're more comfortable not talking about resurrection.
Right, so
but they're willing to give you a HaMeitzim.
Yeah, but you know, the Reform Shul needs an art scroll also, because it's not obvious to a person who's coming into the shul from the temple for the very first time whether you add HaMeitzim.
Of course, because okay. Good. You see, they want to give the authority to the rabbi. See, Jerome, we have to ask Rabbi Levine about how exactly they handle this. What do they do when they reach this in the davening? I mean, what do they say, and how do people know what to say? Right in the on the
no, it's completely.
There's no note at all.
No. He said historically the Gvura takes on the mystery of death.
Yeah, but it doesn't say anything. It doesn't say anything. It's like the German translation. It doesn't say anything. And also, I thought you could point out something else. They know about notes. How do you know they know about notes? Because they have a note for Mashi Baruch Morid HaGeshem and for Morid HaTal. Look, winter Shmini Atzeres Simchas Torah to Pesach, summer Pesach to Shmini Atzeres Simchas Torah. I mean, when they want to give you a note telling you what they do, they know how to give you a note. But they clearly don't want to give you a note here. They want to leave it ambiguous. That's a very important point. They give you the choice. They don't want to tell you, number one, they don't want to explain what the choice is. They give you some kind of very, you know, very, very obscure note.
It's when your father comes.
Yeah.
The note says, our Reform tradition says, we don't say HaMeitzim. That's
right.
What the note says. Our
right.
Reform tradition says, we can't call. If your father comes, so he doesn't give you a hard time, it's there.
Good, okay, right. It says our Reform tradition emphasizes life. Right, Mechayah Kovet. It does, right, okay, very good. Okay, you say when your father comes, you want to remember the way it was, this is the return to tradition. Again, it's very interesting to read about it. It's interesting to read Neil Gilman's article about where this comes from. But when you're standing there on Shabbos morning in Rosh Shalom, I don't know what to do. Okay? Now, very good. One last point. Yes. One last point, we have to give a little bit of time to the Orthodox. The Koran Sitter. It's been written about all over the place, and Jerome just sent me, actually, just this evening, just sent me another review of the Koran Sitter. The Koran Sitter is a new, modern Orthodox Sitter, which is kind of a reaction to Art Scroll. In the 1980s, the modern Orthodox community, well, let me start like this. In the 1960s, the modern Orthodox community, the Rabbinical Council of America, had a sitter. It was a sitter that was edited by Rabbi David de Solopoul. And it was a sitter which was considered to be modern Orthodox. What made it modern Orthodox was just the fact that it was edited by Rabbi David de Solopoul, and it was a Rabbinical Council of America sitter, and most of the shuls, which were Rabbinical Council of America shuls, which were modern Orthodox shuls, used the Rabbi David de Solopoul sitter. The most interesting thing about that sitter was that it was only a Shabbos and Yom Tov sitter. In the 60s, most modern Orthodox Jews didn't come to shul during the week. If you davened at home, you found a sitter to daven during the week. The Birnbaum, which was used, was never the official sitter of the Rabbinical Council of America, which is interesting, okay? The Rav didn't like the Birnbaum sitter, but that's a discussion for some other time. Now, in the 1980s, they replaced the solar pool with the Art Scroll sitter. That also took a little bit of time. I remember in my shul in Washington that if there were, you know, just like today, you come to KRA and we have some Koran Sidurim and we have some Art Scroll Sidurim. So I remember in Washington for a while, there was the solar pool and there was the Art Scroll. You know, there was a little bit of transition time. But they took the Art Scroll. But the Art Scroll was really a kind of right-wing Orthodox sitter, which came through the Art Scroll series, which was a right-wing series. Then they kind of, They put out a modern Orthodox edition of the Siddur. What was modern Orthodox about it? Number one, is that a prayer for the state? And number two is an introduction by Rabbi Saul Berman. Okay? So that's what they have. That's been true until this year. That was true. Okay? Now, Rabbi Sacks, now, in England, they always had a different sitter, okay? What they did now in America is they have, they've taken the British sitter with the commentary and the introduction now of Chief Rabbi Sacks, and they put it out as an OU sitter. Here it is available, and it's called the, here, I have something called the Advanced Preview Copy. I actually have a couple of Advanced Preview Copies. The first Advanced Preview Copy, well, I thought I should have brought it, which is kind of funny, is called the Sacks sitter. But obviously, somebody didn't like that. And then they changed it. It's now called the Koren sitter. That's the print is called, it's the Koren type. So, and here you have it. It's the bilingual edition, and there have been many articles about it. They changed the Hebrew and the English. Usually the Hebrew is here, the English is here. They changed the, they switched the sides. And, you know, it's supposed to be a more elegant translation. It has a special service, Yom HaAtzmaut. It's supposed to be more modern Orthodox. I want to point out something which I think is very interesting, which I don't think many people have pointed out about this sitter. Look at the last page. This is from Mincha on Shabbos. And look what I underlined. I underlined three words in the Hebrew and two words in the English. What did I underline? Mincha on Shabbos. In Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. Mincha on Shabbos in Israel, you know, generally, and the Ashkenazic tradition is that for Mincha and Marim, instead of Sim Shalom, we say Shalom Rav. But you know, in Israel, they say Sim Shalom. That's the Graz Minhag, to say Sim Shalom. What they do here is they include the tradition in Israel. This, the Koren Sacks Sitter, is the first Orthodox Sitter in history that is made to be used across the Atlantic. That is made to be used in Israel and also in the diaspora. There has been no sitter like that. If you open up the Art Scroll sitter is a what? Is a Chutzlaret sitter, completely a diaspora sitter. There's a Rinat Yisrael sitter that has a Chutzlaret version and it has an Israel version.
But if you look at the really old sitter, from Israel, they
will have I'm talking about in the modern, right. If you go to Israel, you go to any shul in Israel, you open up the sitter in the shul, it's an Israeli sitter, right? It has all the Israeli things, which means it has the, you know, it has, you know, Birkas Kohanim, it has Dukkening during the week, yeah.
Is anybody in Israel going to use this sitter?
So that's my point. That's where I was going. I mean, who is this for? Is this for the Israeli? What, the Israeli cares? The Chief Rabbi Sacks has an elegant English? What does this mean? What is it for? What?
For us when we go to Israel.
That's what I think. It shows that we live in an age when everybody's going back and forth. It's for us. You're supposed to take your sitter with you, Mark. Okay? It's kind of a funny thing, right? It's kind of a funny, I don't think they have a pocket edition yet. Right? They do? Oh, they do. Okay.
Is it now if you go to Israel on a 2-day chag, everybody keeps 1-day chag?
So yeah, that's a different, I don't like it all that. No, I didn't call this, there's a pocket of the COVID. So the point is like this, it's very good. The idea is like this. When you have the Koren, pocket Koren sitter in your tefillin bag, and you go back and forth between New York and Israel, or London and Israel, there should be a sitter that you can use in both places. It's the first time that you have this reality that people are going back and forth so often that you actually need a sitter that's both for Israel and for Chutzlaret. So what's interesting here is, what do I see from here? We talked here about the sitter, and it's really very interesting to see the evolution of the Sidurim as it reflects, you know, ideology, as it reflects the move from Germany to the United States and all of these things. Within the Orthodox movement, the change in liturgy is going to be minor, right? They're going to add a prayer for the state or for a Yom HaAtzmaut or that kind of thing. But you see, even within the Orthodox, the sitter does, for lack of a better term, move with the times. The moving with the times is not changing the Shmon Esrei, it's not changing the Bracha, but it is changing what? It's changing the way the sitter is used. For the first time, they want to tell you that this sitter can be used any day during the year and any place you want to use it.
Okay, I'll get to one second. Yeah. Koran, they actually have a whole section on halachas if you go
back and forth. That shows it, right? Okay, right. Yeah.
When you look at the changes that the reform
Reforming, from the Orthodox perspective, those are radical changes. They're saying that the changes the modern Orthodox made are minor, but I'm not sure if someone from outside the modern Orthodox community, say more right-wing, wouldn't say that the modern Orthodox changes are radical.
Good. That's a good question. Now, I did a little bit of research on that. What I try to look for is a right-wing review of the Koren Siddur. That would have been interesting. I couldn't find one. I mean, they're not even interested in the Siddur. This is an OU Siddur. They weren't even interested in reviewing it. That would be interesting to see what they thought of the Koren Siddur, whether they thought there was a problem in the Koren Siddur. I'm not sure what they would find the problem to be, but that is an interesting question. Okay. Yes, Jerome.
Orthodox synagogues going to be picking up the Koran. My own opinion is that they're not going to be useful. It's very expensive, and it will come to the thought
that
the art scroll came in when there was nothing else.
Good. So that, so you see, that is a question which is not an ideological question. That's a practical question which we can't answer. We can't answer now. I'll tell you that you can come to my shul in Washington. To this day, you can come to my shul in where I grew up in Washington, and you will see 500 DeSola Pool Sidurim in the bookcase. What are they there for? Because what are you going to do with them? They were there for what they were there, and you know, at some point they started using the art scroll, and that's what they do. I don't go there anymore, so I don't know whether they use the Koran or not. But that's what happened. So, you know, at some point, what are you going to do with your art scroll Sidurim? So I don't know what that's going to be. Only time will tell. The same way only time will tell in the Reform Siddur whether this Aleinu 1 and Aleinu 2 or Mechaya HaKol Mechaya Nathan works. Anyway, obviously this is an entire semester about the Siddur, but I think it's fascinating just to be able to kind of tell, you know, to kind of touch the tip of the iceberg on this. See everybody. Have a good week. See everybody next week.
Why did you say?